where his thesis was one of the first thesi put online as he wrote it. However, there's also a print copy at the University of Virginia Library. The University of Virginia was the technical advisor for the Blake Project. He informs me that he just got word from MIT Press that his book has been accepted. It's called Mechanisms. I'm always envious of people who have a single title book names, single word book titles. So what we're going to do is Matt's going to give us his presentation. We'll have some discussion, and then we'll move to Jeff Bowker's presentation. And let me just introduce Jeff. He's over here in the front row. He's an active member of the Digital Cultures Project, and he is a professor of communication at the University of California at San Diego. I think he's the most profoundly literate scholar in the social sciences I've ever discovered. He always makes me feel like I don't read much. He is the author with Lee Starr of Sorting Things Out. We'll have a short discussion after Matt's lecture and then go to Jeff's. Okay, Matt.
Thank you, Bill. Sound okay? Okay. Handouts are coming around. So, let's talk about bibliography. Now, most people think that a bibliography is that list of articles and books at the end of your own work. And that's wrong, or at least it's only at best a very partial piece of the truth. Bibliography to me is really the oldest and the most sophisticated form of media studies that we have. And here's a look at what media studies was around 1933. This is Sir Walter Wilson Gregg, a British academic. And he writes, "Bibliography is the study of books as tangible objects. It examines the materials of which they are made and the manner in which those materials are put together. It traces their place and mode of origin and so forth. It is not concerned with their contents in a literary sense." I was tempted to start this today by doing, does everyone remember what George Landau did way back in Hypertext, where he has the names from column A and the names from column B, and he asks how many people recognize both, and of course no one is supposed to. So I'm going to be talking today about people like Gregg, also Fredson Bowers, names that I suspect are not known to most people in the room, but which I think are really central to PAD's discussions. There are three different branches of bibliography. There are actually more, but these are the primary three. Enumerative bibliography, analytical, or as it's sometimes called, physical bibliography, and descriptive bibliography. Now, enumerative bibliography, this is what most of us think about when we hear the word bibliography and then cringe. This is the making lists component to bibliography, and most people agree that the first bibliographer of note was one Callimachus of Cyrene, who compiled the catalog for the library at Alexandria. Analytical or physical bibliography, this is really a forensic science. It is the examination of the book object, the book as a physical object or artifact, for material clues, material evidence of its own production. One example here, Nathaniel Hawthorne's early novel, Fanshawe. bibliographers have been able to identify five different compositors who set the type for the first edition of the book. And they're able to do that by looking at what bibliographers call accidentals. These are minor variations in spelling and punctuation. For instance, is the word doctor capitalized or not? Is it gray with an E or gray with an A? And doing that kind of comparative analysis, bibliographers know that there are five different people who set the type for that first edition. Okay, great. Why might anyone care about that? Well, we don't have the manuscript to Fanshawe. And we don't know what Hawthorne actually wrote. So when we look at things like punctuation, for instance, we don't know if a given punctuation mark is Hawthorne's own doing, or if it's the work of one of the compositors who was following a kind of house style, or just his own idiosyncrasy. And, you know, everyone knows what Oscar Wilde said, I spent all morning putting in a comma, and I spent all afternoon taking it out. So those minute particulars are very significant. And so analytical bibliography, and I think rightly, is considered really the foundation of textual editing and ultimately literary criticism. Descriptive bibliography follows from analytical, and it is the rigorous, standardized, many would want to argue, scientific description of the book as object. And you can see a glimpse of what descriptive bibliography looks like on the handout that's going around the room. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on. The Bible here is this volume, Principles of Bibliographical Description by Fredson Bowers. Melissa kindly checked this out for me from the UCSB library, and when I asked her to go get it, I was reasonably confident that it would be in the stacks. And in fact, checking, I see that the last time it was out was 1992. So this is one of Bauer's more memorable and colorful statements, and it really, I think, it captures the spirit of the enterprise. Many a literary critic has investigated the past ownership and mechanical condition of his secondhand automobile, or the pedigree and training of his dog more thoroughly than he has looked into the qualifications of the texts on which his critical theories rest. So, you know, this is fundamentally the question, where do texts come from, right? You know, so we read the Canterbury Tales, and let's say we buy Penguin's Canterbury Tales. Well, what is that? Where does it come from? There are 88 different manuscript versions of the Canterbury Tales that survive, and none of them correspond to what you find in that penguin. So where do texts come from? These are the questions that bibliography and also textual criticism seek to answer. Okay. This is my first time using PowerPoint. Be forewarned. So what we're looking at here, of course, this is Rob Kendall's Directory of Electronic Literature, which is part of the ELO site. This is a classic instance of enumerative bibliography, and I think we've done pretty well at that. We've done very well with it. What we haven't done so well with, I think, is analytical and descriptive bibliography. And I think this has something to do with what until pretty recently was the common prejudice or the common basis of our thinking about electronic media, namely that it's somehow ethereal, ephemeral, it's something that just sort of floats through the air like vapor. And, you know, recently there have been a number of people working to counter that line of argument. In addition to myself, Rita Rowley, Kay Tells, Johanna Drucker, a number of people have been sort of pushing the materiality of electronic objects. My own term for it is the haptic fallacy, the notion that because we can't reach out and touch it, it's somehow immaterial. Okay, we do know, though, I mean, anyone who has even a passing familiarity with computers does know that electronic objects exist in space and time. We're looking at a Unix directory listing here. We see date and time stamps. We see kilobytes of memory consumed. We also know that electronic objects are, to a really a large extent, self-documenting. And just, I mean, think about this for a moment. We take it for granted. Think about it in relation to print culture. What if we knew precisely when our printed documents were created and revised? There some of the discussion yesterday, the fact that, I think Joe was getting at this, Joe Tabby, when writers write nowadays, they don't methodically save drafts and revisions of their work, and that's true, but there are other forms of documentation that begin to reassert themselves. So it's a question of just learning to, I think, become comfortable with the way in which digital objects self-document. What we really lack, I think, in our community is a sophisticated vocabulary for expressing the synchronic and diachronic changes, that's space and time, that inform the material makeup of digital objects. And, here's an easy example. Here we have afternoon. Well, which one is it? This is the first Macintosh edition on the left. The Starry Space, or I should say, sorry, the Eastgate Windows version on the right. It's not just a question of a different typeface or one has a graphic and one doesn't. The third edition has about 100 more links. It has several more writing spaces. The text has been revised and edited by Michael. The whole structure of it feels very different. Jane Yevalise Douglas comments that the addition of Alexia called I Call to the third edition really changes just the way the whole thing behaves. So here we are in PAD. Which of these are we going to preserve? The first one is arguably the more historically significant because of the dating. The third edition is sort of arguably the more familiar to us. It's the one that I think most of us read. Which to preserve? So these are precisely the problems that bibliographers and textual scholars have been dealing with for a long time. There are any number of parallel examples in the history of printed literature. One of my favorites is Frankenstein. The first edition is published anonymously by Mary Shelley in 1818. By the time you get to the third edition, it's no longer anonymous. However, she's also rewritten portions of it. So the suggestion of an incest plot, which appeared in the first edition, has been removed from the third edition. So, these are not just, these are more ultimately than just commas and quotation marks. These are substantive revisions to texts. So what I want to do here is, taking my cue from Professor Bowers, is work towards some principles of computational description. And I'm going to run through these pretty quickly, but just to give you a taste of, again, the way Bowers was writing about this stuff back in 1949. The descriptive bibliography seeks to furnish a detailed analytical record of the physical characteristics of the book, which would simultaneously serve as a trustworthy source of identification and as a medium to bring an absent book before a reader's eyes. I think we heard something about that yesterday. A slightly longer quote. I think what's important here is the comparative nature of it. Bibliographers want to examine multiple copies of the same, quote unquote, the same book to look for minor variants in what's known as state. Sometimes at the press, a form of type would fall off and the type would have to be reset. So even within the same edition, same run of an edition, it's not unusual to find typographical variants. You can tell bibliographers when you look at their libraries because it's not uncommon for them to have dozens or even hundreds of copies of quote-unquote the same book sitting on their shelves. And again, it's because they're interested in the book as an object or artifact. They're not interested so much in sort of the content of the thing. This, I think, is pretty important. Bowers here takes pains to assert that, strictly piling up facts strictly for the sake of piling up facts is not all that bibliography is. And I think particularly what he says here at the end is very important for Pad. The history of an author's book is an intimate part of the literary history of that author. If we want to know something about, Margie, we need to know something about her work, her books, and the permutations that they've gone through. These are Bauer's foundational terms. I'm not going to take, really the time to go through them. Again, just to give you a taste, an edition, for instance, is all copies of the book printed from the same setting of type. And then, impression, issue, state, those are sort of further refinements of the concept of an edition. My very, very, very provisional terminology for describing digital objects, and I don't want this to be the sort of thing where I present this as definitive and then we all try to sort of poke holes in it during the discussion session. But these are just the terms I've begun to think about. Release, version, layer, object, state, instance, and copy. And what I want to just use as kind of a test case for applying these, David Blair's Wax Web. It's, as many of you know, Wax Web is the online successor to his very experimental 1991 film, Wax. Have people seen Wax? It's remarkable, actually. It's all digitally processed video. Wax is one of the earliest digital films that we have. It also has the distinction of having been distributed across the M-Bone back in 1993, well before real media. Okay. I'm going to sort of read for just a little bit. Consisting of over 2,000 separate nodes and 25,000 links, WaxWeb is one of the largest creative hypermedia environments extant today. I don't know if Gramatron, for instance, is bigger or not, but WaxWeb is certainly one of the largest. It dwarfs a work like Afternoon, which Afternoon has about 600 nodes and under 1,000 links. More interesting than simply size is the fact that WaxWeb occupies several parallel media planes, which currently include or have at one time included story space documents, MOO objects, HTML, JPEG image files, MPEG video, WAV audio files, and you can just see the scope and extent of this, VRML objects and scenes that were derived directly from the 3D primitives that were used in the film version. This complex media ecology has evolved over 6 years of online development. As new technologies and data standards have become available, the project has been ported and migrated across several platforms and file systems, discarding some of its earlier media while absorbing and layering others. In December of 1998, Blair replaced what had previously been listed as version 3.0 alpha of the online Wax Web with a, quote, preview of the final internet CD release containing, quote, substantial revisions. This version makes extensive use of the Java programming language and real-time streaming audio and video. As of today, Wax is available both on the web and also on CD-ROM. Now, clearly, WaxWeb presents us with an enormously complex textual situation, and one that I would hope makes clear the need to begin building kind of a shared vocabulary for discriminating among the different material elements and temporal states of electronic compositions. My first thought was simply to retain Bauer's terms and suggest how we might begin to distinguish between different editions, impressions, states, and so forth for an electronic object. This terminology, however, I soon found inadequate. Bauer's definitions of terms are heavily dependent on the material specificity of their medium. That's their great value. There really wasn't a clear analog, for example, to an edition in electronic media, defined by Bauer's as all copies printed from a single setting of type, and so forth. So what I decided to do was to invent a kind of updated vocabulary. Okay, the first three terms, layer, version, and release, really sort of, I think, need to be understood together. A layer is, of course, first of all, it's a building block in models of computer networking. The way that I use the term here, a layer comprises all elements of an electronic work that are both computationally compatible and functionally integrated. When one or more elements are ported such that the whole is no longer computationally compatible or functionally integrated, then a new layer is created. And there's an example coming at the end of all this, which I hope sort of puts it all together. So just bear with me for a moment while I deploy the terminology. Layers can be distinguished by assigning them versions. David Blair himself has version, you can see his versioning of WaxWeb. I would argue that one of the things that we as bibliographers of electronic literature want to do is assert our own authority to version works according to their material circumstances. And as you'll see from the handout, my versioning of Wax differs from David's own. A release of the work I define different releases of the work are all computationally compatible with one another, but they are not functionally integrated. So the example there would be the CD-ROM versus the web version of Wax. Okay, object, obviously a word that has multiple associations for us. In object-oriented programming, an object is a discrete unit of code that consists of both data and instructions for operating on that data. It's also become common to use object as a kind of generic identifier. For example, a multimedia object is an accepted way of referring to an image, a video, or a sound file. And then there's finally sort of the artifactual sense of the word, where we might refer to Afternoon itself as a digital object, even though it actually consists of a great many different parts, which are themselves objects in the computational sense. My use of it here is really that middle ground. I'm defining an object as a generic identifier for some discrete digital entity, such as a file. And if you ask me to define a file, I would say that a file is a named collection of data that persists over time. Okay. State. A state refers to the computational composition of an object in some particular data format. So it's a little bit hard to make out, but this is an image from Wax, and it's in both JPEG and GIF format. And what we see here are, in Photoshop, two separate histograms. And what this reveals to me is that even though optically, visually, the two formats look identical to us, computationally, they're very different. And if you know something about how GIF and JPEG are structured as file formats, they work very differently, and the histogram reveals that. Okay, an instance refers to a particular object in a particular state as presented in a particular software environment. And my favorite example here is a simple HTML page. On the left, you see it in the text-only links browser. On the right, you see it in some version of Netscape, a more conventional graphical browser. The key point here is that this is the same underlying HTML file that is generating both presentations. And this is something, for instance, that Lev Manovic talks about in his Languages of New Media. He sees it rightly as one of the characteristics of new media, that we get multiple versions, what I call multiple instances, derived from the same underlying digital object. Okay, finally, a copy is kind of in some ways almost a kind of philosophical term here, but it's used to It refers to one precise and particular instance of one particular state of an object. And so if I download an image in JPEG from the web, the copy that gets cached on my local machine, even though it's computationally most of the time identical to the copy on the server, it's still ontologically a different thing. So that is how I'm using term copy. Okay, let's see if we can put this all together. And this is where you want to take a look at the diagram in the handout. I have a few more copies of it up here. Does anyone still need diagram? Okay. What you're going to see in what follows is one single digital object, the frame of video that you see there from the original wax film, presented in two separate states, both real video and JPEG, four separate instances, all distributed across three layers and versions of the work. I've spent enough time with this that I no longer have a good grasp of the extent to which it is or isn't self-explanatory. But what you see there, what I've tried to do is to indicate, first of all, the different layers, and you can see the technical formats associated with each layers. You can see the version numbers I've assigned, and I also included David's own versioning of WAX, the dates that are associated with those different versions, and then our video image. If you start at the bottom, you see the original still. If we go up then to version 3.0, we see it presented as an inline JPEG. If we go up to version 4.0, the fifth layer, we see that same frame of video. It's presented as both part of a real video stream. It's presented as an inline JPEG in the middle screenshot. I know those are very poor quality. Okay, so on the left here, this is the real video. Okay. In the middle, we have the inline JPEG. On the right here, we have VRML. And so just to work with the terminology a little bit, in the VRML, again, I know it's all but sort of illegible, but what you actually see there on that hexagonal VRML object, texture mapped is the JPEG image file, that video frame. And it is the same digital object that is texture mapped in the VRML that's presented as the inline JPEG. Yet it's the same object in the same state, JPEG, but two different instances. In the middle, we have the Netscape presentation. Here we have, I think this was a Cosmo player that I was using. Okay, should I say more about this, or should I move on? I think I have, actually. So that there we have state and instance. You see the layers, you see the versions. Release really doesn't come into it here, but again, the example there would be the distinction between the web WAX and then the CD-ROM release of the same work. Okay, let me move on, and we can continue to sort it out during the discussion if we have time. Okay, very nice. Isn't this exactly what library science exists to do? We heard a lot about NETs and other standards yesterday. I don't think so. As I understand them, NETs and other initiatives like it don't help so much with the problem of expressing the relationships between multiple versions and states of an individual work. And this is really what's at the core of the bibliographical enterprise. And I think those relationships between different versions and states really have to be central to our enterprise with PAD. If we're going to that word work that I use too, if we're going to talk about afternoon, for instance, you know, my rhetorical question before, which version do we want to archive, the obvious answer is both. Well and good, but then we still need a way of talking about the relationship between the afternoon that we have on the left and the afternoon that we have on the right. And that's, I think, precisely where bibliography and the lessons that we can learn from what people have been doing for generations with printed books can come into play. Also, the other CVS, the concurrent version system. There's a lot that we can learn from what developers have done. Version control is a well-understood problem in computer science. There are tools and architectures that exist to manage it. And I think the existence of that work, the existence of such tools and architectures, that gives us another way into thinking about versioning electronic objects. And it's sort of like looking through the reverse end of the telescope. But tools like this, these are the way that developers think about different versions. And the sorts of things that I've been sort of at great pains to talk about this morning, at some level, I think they're understood instinctively by developers who know that actually version control is a, you know, bad enough problem that one needs specialized tools to manage it. Okay. Like Howard, Bowers understood the importance of standards. And I wanted to wind up with, or get close to winding up, with this quotation from him. It's necessary in the extreme for bibliographers like chemists or mathematicians to agree on a standard and uniform system of notation, so forth. I told you it was my first time using PowerPoint. Okay, recommendations for PAD. Recognize the value of the critical knowledge analytical and descriptive bibliography afford for traditional literary studies. Okay. Help foster analytical and descriptive bibliographical practices for the electronic literature community by developing and disseminating standardized principles of computational description. Not necessarily mine, but I think, you know, again, what I've tried to do this morning is not necessarily foist this particular set of terms on you, but rather make the case that we need a set of terms to fill this gap. And finally, and perhaps most importantly for PAD, as we say, tightly couple any such principles of computational description to our technical metadata and encoding practices. So if we were to use a term like instance, for example, that should be built into the actual encoding that we're doing in PAD. Okay, and I will stop there. Thank you.
We actually only, because of the little longer plan, we just have a few. Let me just ask a few questions.
Jeff?
This is very clear and helpful, and I appreciate that.
There's a butt coming, right?
What I'm thinking of as a Nigerian is, in my career, I took a bibliography course in graduate school. Mm-hmm. Studying literature and American in grad school. Mm-hmm. And I heard about Bowers, and worked with some texts.
Right.
I know very few grads departments anymore that require this course. Mm-hmm. So even though I think in principle what you're suggesting is, I've often told colleagues that, in a way, electronic literature is a more general version of the bibliography in literary studies.
Right.
But it's arriving at the very time when bibliography in literature departments is no longer a component. So I think that it's a great loss. Mm-hmm. And this may be moments in the revival of However, it falls to the individual, as do most things in this environment, to do the kind of tracing, registering of additions and layers, etc., that's, once we're the province of the
Point well taken. And I think actually, with the rise of new media studies and electronic literature, there have been indications, that's really, sort of helped revitalize the bibliographical and textual studies community. First of all, you had sort of a first generation of people who were doing, work in electronic editing back in the, from the late 80s and early 90s forward. And then, I was just at the Society for Textual Studies in New York City the other week. Noah was there too. And so, there was one session where Bradford Cowley and Tom Beller, who have both done really interesting things on the web. Bradford Cowley is the guy who did TextArc, if you've seen that amazing textual visualization tool. So Bradford was presenting, Tom Beller runs Mr. Beller's Neighborhood. Then, while those sessions were going on, you could still wander into other rooms and hear people talking about, well, this is how I, constructed the apparatus for my Wordsworth edition. But, there's a real, sort of cross-fertilization. It's happening at places like the Society for Textual Scholarship and also places like the Association for Computers and the Humanities, which has a biannual conference. Stephanie?
Is it possible to do this kind of work without the ideal copy?
Yeah.
I think you have to think about it as someone else.
Yeah. Bowers was not platonic in this. For him, an ideal copy was a copy of the book that was sort of all-encompassing. It consisted of the most bibliographical evidence that one could hope to find. It was not sort of the perfect copy. But that said, I do think one of the most important things that's happened in textual studies since Bowers is an appreciation for sort of the inherent importance of all individual states of a work and not just sort of one sort of finished version.
And then just following on from that issue, how would you regard different time states of something like River Island?
Mm-hmm.
Each instance would be completely different.
Right. Once we get into time-dependent media, that's when I actually think the analogy to bibliography starts to break down a little bit. I do think, film studies is another place to look, and they're another community that has evolved, fairly, sophisticated means of talking about the objects they study.
But none of your terms will cover those different spaces.
That's why they're provisional.
Okay.
Howard?
Let me just recap a couple of things that were said yesterday that I think are highly relevant here. Someone, I don't remember who, said, is it the responsibility of the author to do the metadata, to do the analysis, to prepare for preservation? In other words, these kinds of things, should they be done by the author themselves, or should they be done by someone else after the work? Second things that I said yesterday about trying to embed into the software itself and into the kind of workflow process certain kinds of things that might in fact allow for this type of analysis afterwards in a better way, because the actual way in which the author works may have been captured. Can you comment on both of those?
Here I would want to sort of assert the importance of an editor. I don't necessarily think we want to leave it up to authors to describe, encode, edit, curate their own works. You can see that, if we're going to talk about things like standards, for instance, which, both ourselves and Bowers were well aware of their importance, to the extent that my own little vocabulary was a kind of, self-created standard, my versioning of WAX differed from David Blair's. And in order for the system to be useful, I think while David's would want to make note of that, I think in terms of sort of the structural functioning of the system, one would want an editor's versioning to be the authoritative.
Just one more question.
In the back.
Very
very quickly. Bowers, could you give us the name of the book again?
Yeah, let me go back to the slide. Fredson Bowers, Principles of Bibliographical Description.
Okay, and the other thing I wanted to ask you about is what you described as a haptic fallacy.
Yeah.
Is that presented in any concrete form, in any concrete form where because I think it should be a great value, I think it's very important what I'm doing.
Yeah. Do you mean is there an article behind it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. It's a piece called Editing the Interface.
Editing the Interface.
Editing the Interface. It's in a journal called Text, T-E-X-T, Volume 14, 2002.
Volume 14, 2002.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.